On September 29, 2023, the Bozeman Public Library welcomed author, journalist, and fly fisherman John McLean, along with Valerie Hemingway, to discuss Ernest Hemingway's short story, A Big Two-Hearted River, a story which changed the direction of McLean's life. Library Director Susan Gregory introduces Valerie Hemingway, who later introduces McLean.
Valerie Hemingway is a longtime member of the Hemingway family. She was Ernest Hemingway's secretary at one point. She met him when she was a journalist in Madrid, a very young and lovely journalist. Her life story is fascinating. Someday, if you haven't read it, read her book, Running with the Bulls. It is extraordinary. She married Ernest Hemingway's youngest son, and actually was in publishing and editing in New York City. You lived in Paris. You were born in Dublin, Madrid, and then Montana.
Havana,
don't let me forget Havana. There's a great picture in Running with the Bulls where she is actually, I think, fishing with Castro. So, Valerie is a Bozeman treasure. We're very fortunate she's here this evening, and obviously there's a link with our book and Mr. McLean. So let me introduce Valerie Hemingway.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's my great pleasure to introduce this evening Mr. John McLean. When Susan and Beth offered me this task, I'd not yet met John, nor read his gripping memoir, which I have here, Home Waters, strongly recommend it. And neither had I met his read his father's masterpiece, A River Runs Through It. I'm so glad I said yes, because I was in for a wonderful treat, and it's not over yet. Both books have given me immense enjoyment, and meeting the man himself, which I only did a short time before your meeting him, has been a thrill that I've been greatly looking forward to, and I'm looking forward to what he has in store for us tonight. The book that John will be focusing on here is the centennial edition of Ernest Hemingway's A Big Two-Hearted River. That was one of his very early works, and at the time when he started it, he was 24 years old. And being a very dedicated writer from the very beginning, he worked on this and he wrote and rewrote it, and it was a good 3 years, 3 to 4 years before it was published. And even later, much stuff that had been used was culled from it, then was published after he died. Because he was so meticulous about his work that, his craft, he used to call it his métier, and he preserved every word. I mean, there was no waste paper basket in the Hemingway in his writing. Well, he wrote in Havana in his bedroom, and he preserved everything because he never knew when you might. He felt it was like money in the bank. His words for him were that was his savings account. So he always put his aside in case he needed it later. John has taken the book and he has an engrossing introduction, which is as long as the story itself. So he'll be filling you in on what he has to say about it. Like Hemingway, John is a lifelong newspaper man and an accomplished author. They both hailed from Chicago and spent their childhood summers, Ernest in Michigan and John in Montana, mastering the skills of hunting and fishing, pursuits which they continued to enjoy throughout their lives. Literature and fly fishing, no other writers have paired these two pursuits with such skill as the McLeans, father and son, and Ernest Hemingway. I mean, I might have a couple of writer friends in the room who take objection to that, because we have a couple of good fly fishing writers right here among us, I can see as I'm talking. I was fortunate in my youth to work for Hemingway as his secretary and general dog's body for a couple of years, during which time he taught me to shoot and fish, among other things. You know, it's funny when people say, what did you do as Hemingway's secretary? Well, you pretty much had to do everything that that needed to be done. A lot of that was sitting and listening and speaking up when requested. And I mean, there was the regular stuff, but also you had to join in all the sports and whatever was going on. We went to the bullfights, the horse races, and with Hemingway, you were never just you were always a participant. You were never just a spectator. That he had no time for spectators, and especially himself, he was not a good spectator, except when he was looking at something that he was going to write about later. And then he could be a very good spectator because he was observing. The fishing that I did with Hemingway was not fly fishing, it was deep sea fishing. Later, I came to learn fly fishing here in Montana from two experts, his sons, my late ex-husband Gregory and his brother Patrick, who still lives here in Bozeman and active at a ripe old age of 95. Patrick also, well, he taught all our family to fly fish, and my son Sean, who's now, he's the head of the Greek and Roman department at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, he is an avid fly fisher. He's the one who you know, there's always one who takes it on, and he, when his daughter was five, I think she was the only child in America who was given her first fly fishing rod as her graduation present from kindergarten. So one of my vivid memories of the time working for Hemingway was an occasion when we were in the south of France, where he was working on the Garden of Eden. Ernest was approached by a young man who said, "Mr. Hemingway, I've just read your book." He mentioned the name of one of the novels and then asked Hemingway what he was thinking about when he wrote a certain passage. Ernest's response was, "I remember exactly what prompted that incident, but it doesn't matter what I thought or felt. When you read a book, it is your own experience you bring to it, and each time you read it, your understanding may be different." Well, tonight, a new depth will be added to our understanding of Hemingway's little masterpiece, Big Two-Hearted River, when John shares his insights with us. Welcome, John.
Thank you all for coming. I can't tell you how much of a privilege it is to be introduced by Valerie Hemingway, but I think you will understand by the time I finish talking exactly how much of a privilege it is. When you're 80 years old, when you have an 80th birthday, your family tends, if you haven't been a complete horse's behind, your family tends to do nice things for you. And I turned 80 in May of this year, and some of my grandchildren got together and they sent me a sheet of paper about that size, and they'd all said things that they like about Granddad. And one of them said, "We like the stories Granddad tells us about the Civil War when we drive around the Virginia countryside." And another said, "We like it that Granddad always is reading a book." And another said, "We liked it when Granddad killed the big timber rattler while we were camping in the Blue Ridge. Had 13 rattles on it." And I took that page and framed it and put it on my desk. But I'd had an extraordinary present the day before, the kind of thing that just doesn't happen. On May 9th, the day before my birthday, on May 10th, A book came out on which I shared a byline with Ernest Hemingway, mine's smaller, on a story that had changed my life almost 7 decades earlier, and that had changed my father's life, Big Two-Hearted River. That kind of thing, it just doesn't happen. So to think through how this could have come to pass has taken me a lot of time. My dad gave me Big Two-Hearted River to read when I was about 13 or 14 years old. I've gone back and tried to reconstruct the moment, and I can't, and I think that Valerie's talking about it's different every time. You bring a different understanding to events and to books every time you experience them. It's correct, because that first reading galvanized my mind about fishing. My father and I both lived as schizophrenics. We would spend our summers out here in Montana, where it's gorgeous, and we fished. And then we would go back to the University of Chicago neighborhood, Hyde Park, where you're in this rarefied intellectual atmosphere that has nothing to do with mountains and trout. And I couldn't put it together. And I'll be honest with you, neither could he for a long time. This is a point of tension. And when I read Big Two-Hearted River, suddenly I realized that fly fishing can be put in a book, because Hemingway put you right on the river. He put the rod in your hand. He let you fight the fish. He let you lose the fish. He knew exactly what it felt like. And I went to my father, very excited about this. And he said, yes, you know what this also shows? It shows that fly fishing can be literature. I was watching the movie of A River Runs Through It last night for the first time in a very long time. And in it, my dad goes off to the University of Chicago at the age of 26. And he did that at a time when no academy had such a thing as a Department of American Literature, because academicians didn't believe there was such a thing. He joined the English Department of the University of Chicago. And it only evolved over time that American literature came to be formed and understood and respected and taught, and Ernest Hemingway is one of the big reasons that happened. All right, that is a long time ago that happened. It's in the 1950s. It took my dad a long time to get from that point the realization that fishing could be literature, and that there was an American voice that was a legitimately literary voice to actually do it. He wanted all his life to be a writer. It consumed him in a way that was not particularly healthy, because he was frustrated by not being a writer. He was a great teacher and recognized as a great teacher. He won a Quantrell Award for undergraduate teaching several times, and had it denied to him several times because he won it on votes. But the faculty said, you can't keep giving this award to the same guy year after year. You got to spread it around to some of these other young people who are coming up. So he was a success that way, but he wasn't a success as a writer, and he treated himself as a writer. The writers are kind of a pain in the neck, because you have to listen to what they're writing, and you have to treat them with a certain level of respect. And he wanted that and got it. But where were the books? At the age of 70, having retired from the University of Chicago, when my mother was gone, when he had gone through a long patch of very serious illness, he sat down and began to write for real. He had written for real before, but it hadn't worked. He tried to write a big book about the Custer fight, and it failed. He tried to write other things, and he tried little short things. We'd have to sit there while he read them to us and analyze them. And said, is 1,000 words. It's not some great long thing. But he started to write for real at the age of 70. And I can read the river runs through the stories in the background, in the back of the book, those two stories. Those are the first ones he wrote. And they're not big enough and strong enough to establish and sustain a literary reputation. Good stories, but not stories. And he got done with them and had a think. And he said, these stories, I tried to write about my brother Paul. And they're not about Paul. His name's not him. There's nothing about fishing in them. He said, if I'm going to really do this, I'm going to have to write a straight story about Paul, my brother, and his murder. And it's going to have to be about fishing. I don't know if he articulated it as fully as that, but I know he thought that and said that afterwards that was the decision. So he wrote a straight story about Paul and about fishing. And it turned into literary magic. First printing was 1,500 copies. And almost immediately there was a second printing. And then it became a cult book among the fly fishing fraternity as we are sitting here today. People such as you would pick it up and pass it along. And then there was the Redford movie and boom, off she went. But the Redford movie should be considered separately on its several merits. But the book itself is now recognized as a great piece of American literature. And he was exalted. He got it. He was a writer. And people were saying he was a great writer for a 104-page story. And Robert Redford was knocking on his door. A day late, my dad opened the door and said, Robert, you're late. And he closed the door. That's my old man. There was a great flurry of people who knew what was going on, and they got involved. The lines got back up. And Redford was wonderful to him. I've had almost nothing to do with the movie or with Redford. I was heavily engaged at the time. I was the foreign editor in Chicago Tribune. And Redford gave him full creative veto. This doesn't happen. An author never gets this kind of thing. But he was allowed a veto. So he did a script, and another script, and another script, and finally he got a script that they showed on tab. And in it, a certain professor of literature had written this thing, and it begins on Seedy Lake, where our town is. And Paul is out at the end of the dock, and he's casting, and he catches a big rainbow trout, and he gets him in, and the camera closes in on the rainbow trout. Paul breaks his neck. My father had to be scraped off the roof. And that stopped it. That stopped the movie. Long pause, quiet, couple of years pass, my father dies. Boom, the movie is made. Now, I'm not saying that Redford waited him out, but that's exactly the effect that it had. And I think in some ways, it's very understandable. I have a lot of admiration for Robert Redford, let me say, at the outset, as a gentleman and as a movie maker. But that's what I think he did. So the movie took off. Fine. My father had tried to write another book after A River Runs Through. So I say he was exalted. He was a writer at last, and he was going to write a lot of books in the time that was left him. And he had lots of ideas. He was going to write a book about the great women of the West who had been neglected, he thought. And he had known some really great ones. And then he was going to write a book about this and a book about that. And he chose to write a short little piece summarizing a fire that had happened in 1949 that he'd had a personal connection to, the Mann Gulch fire. And he was going to whip that thing together and then move on to something else. And he tried to do what I do. He tried to do a repertorial job, nonfiction. And he wrote a draft on it, and he showed it to the editor who had been his champion for A River Runs Through It, and had gotten it published by the University of Chicago Press, when, you know, kind of weird, they'd never published fiction, a book of short stories, about fishing. And this editor looked at what my dad had done and said, "This is a lousy book. You've done a bad job." And unfortunately, it ruined a relationship that had been very productive and very valuable to both of them. But my father rejected the person who gave him the advice and accepted the advice and went back and started to rewrite it. He spent almost 14 years on it. He kept rewriting it and kept rewriting it. Now, I've read the earlier version, and I hadn't said anything to him because I didn't want to say what the editor said and have that kind of reaction against me. You know, there's trouble enough in the world, we don't need that. So I hadn't read the thing when my dad died. We had a very fancy English professor at the University of Chicago read it, and he said, "Well, you probably ought to try to get this published to show how much work he's done," and so on. He wasn't very enthusiastic about it. So we took it to an editor at the University of Chicago Press. And the guy said, "Look, this is the way books come in. It's a little rough. There's some repetitions in here. There's some things that need to be moved around. But this is a hell of a book." It came out at the same time the movie came out and soared to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, along with The River Runs Through. Movies will do that. If you're a writer, you know, if you want to make a living out of this, you've got to get into movies. So fine. I was asked to do the audio version of it, the first audio version of it. And I did it at our cabin at CD Lake. I had a young guy out there who was doing the taping, and we were moving along, and I overheard a conversation he had one evening with his editor. And he said, "I can't believe what's going on." He said, "We're doing 20 or 25 pages without a pause. I've done a number of books since, and that isn't what happens. You do three paragraphs." "So, what? Stop. Can you go back and repeat this? Well, do you, go back and repeat it again." That's the way it goes when you read a book. But with Young Men and Fire, it was just going like that. The commas were all exactly in the right place. They told you when to take a pause, when to take a breath. The rhythm was smooth and flowed right along. I had asked the editor who put it together to write a little memo about what he had done and what he had not done, because I knew what we would be accused of would be that we rewrote Norman's book for him, for commercial reasons and so on. And that isn't really what happened, so please write this thing. So he wrote it, and he said, "Nothing was written in. It was rearranged in places where repetitions were taken out." He said there was one short transition that had to be written. So I'm reading along this 20, 25 pages at a take, and it's just, all of a sudden I get clunk, clunk, clunk. Three sentences that just stopped me. That's what Alan Thomas put in there. So I called up the editor, Alan Thomas. I said, "Is that what you wrote him?" He said, "Yeah, that's what I wrote him. The rest of the book is a dream." That's my dad's writing career. Let me go back to my home. I grew up thinking I was Paul McLean. I was going to be named Paul. Thank God, my mother intervened and stopped that. And my notion of Paul when I was young was that he was a great hero. I wore his fishing shirt, and the shoulders drooped down to about here. He was 5'8", 185 pounds, and it wasn't fat. And I heard stories about this guy, what a wondrous fisherman he was. Then I started hearing other stories from other people that weren't so wondrous. But I became a newspaper man, just as Paul did. I felt very natural in that role. It was probably the only thing I could have done for more than a year without really messing it up. And had a very meteoric career. Not because of my manly beauty and great genius, but because of the Vietnam War. I don't hear well, and I was exempt. The newspaper business was dying for warm bodies who could write. And I was a warm body, and I could write. And so I became the youngest city desk reporter in the history of the Chicago Tribune. And I became the youngest Washington correspondent in the history of the Chicago Tribune. And I became the diplomatic correspondent for the Chicago Tribune when I was in my 20s and flew around the world with Henry Kissinger on a shuttle diplomacy. None of these things were particularly deserved, but I scrambled and hustled and kept my head above water and had a very good career. And in the course of that career, I began to think about Paul. One thing, I had access to the files of the Tribune, and I looked up his murder. And it seemed to me that the stories that I had heard about the murders of my father and elsewhere had this kind of meaningful background to it, that he'd gotten in trouble and in debt, and the people to whom he was in debt had accosted him, and he fought them and died in a particularly honorable battle, but a recognizable battle. It isn't meaningless. It's a step or two above really vulgar. And I looked at the clips on this thing, and it didn't ring true. Timing's all wrong. It's late on a Sunday night into a Monday morning, early hours of Monday morning, African-American neighborhood. There's some statements that he was seen in the neighborhood earlier and was drunk or acting that way. So, I have my own life to live. The thing that I would fault Paul for now is that he never really pulled for himself. When he died in his early 30s, he never had a really meaningful relationship with a woman who could have been his partner, no real partner kind of body. He never really lived off on his own. He was in Helena, had a wonderful newspaper job. He was the political correspondent for the Helena paper. Feared, respected, everybody knew who he was. It's a lifetime kind of job in journalism. But he did get in a lot of debt, gambling, and wound up going to Chicago, where his brother got a job with the University of Chicago when he couldn't get a job with a newspaper. Just a little something off here. Okay, I've got my own life and I'm going along. I have got a wife who's a partner, still is a partner, a great partner, two kids, five grandchildren. They're all beautiful. And smart. And I'm just about to go to college. And we'll deal with that. And I'll go through college and graduate school if they want. So I've gotten into the news game so early, at the age of 21, that by the time I was in my early 50s, 51, 52, I took in 30 years at the Chicago Tribune. I was more than invested. I was bored and ready to get the hell out of there. I've done it. I wasn't going to be an assistant managing editor, and I didn't want to be one. I've been a forum editor, I've been a lot of other things, but I'm done here. Then a fire happened in 1994. The South Canyon Fire on Storm King Mountain in west central Colorado. That killed 14 firefighters, and if you know about it, you know about it. It was the mirror image of the Van Gulch fire, my father's fire. I knew people who knew a lot about the South Canyon fire. One of the families involved principal family lived in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana, not far away from my cabin in Seeley Lake. And the prospect of doing a book loomed. I went. What actually happened was, when the fire happened, my editor walked over and said, "You should be out in Colorado doing this." This was 3 days after the fire started, when they had, I think they still were looking for two of the bodies. And I said, "If I go out there now, you're going to get on a plane byline because of Young Men on Fire. I'm basically Associated Press copy." Why don't we do this differently? The anniversary of the Van Gulch fire is coming up in August. How do I go to Van Gulch and get my dad's research partner and some other people who will go into the Gulch? Everybody says, this is just like Van Gulch. Is it? Let's find out. And my editor said, do it. I've talked to him about this since. You know what's happened to the newspaper business. And one first thing he said to me when we talked about it a few years ago is that, "John, no editor would ever, ever say yes to you today to spend that kind of money." But at the time, the Chicago Tribune was a very wealthy paper, and we did things like that. So I went out there, and we went into the Gulch, and I wrote a story. And the headline writer put on it, "Fire on the Mountain." I thought, boy, that's a great headline. And I wrote a book proposal, "Fire on the Mountain." Everything happened at the same time. The Chicago Tribune had a very quiet buyout. This was a few years before the time when they would pick you up by the scruff of your neck and your belt and throw you out the front door. This was a good buyout, and you had to find out about it by being a good reporter, because they didn't advertise it. I found out about it, and I went in to see our business guy, and I said, "What's the deadline?" He said, "It's noon on such and such a date." Fine. I called my agent, and we were having an auction. There are fishing writers in here. You know what it's like to have an auction for a book. It means there's a lot of interest. This doesn't happen very often. We were having an auction. And I said, "Well, when's it going to be over?" She said, "Well, a little wiggle room." I said, "Let's end it at 10 o'clock in the morning on such and such a date, the date for the noon deadline." So that happened. 10 o'clock in the morning, the auction ended. She called me and she said, "Here's the price." I said, "Okay, I can do it." I went upstairs, and a half an hour later, I signed my exit papers for the Chicago Tribune, and I set off. And I've written about this several times since, because it was kind of a life-changing decision. It came together on an April Fool's Day, which made me wonder then and later if it wasn't going to be a great big joke on me. On that day, many years ago now, I jumped into my Jeep Cherokee with Robert, my Labrador Retriever, and headed west, armed with a book contract, a fly rod, a 12-gauge Remington shotgun, and a mix of hope and fear. It was a new life where everything was possible, nothing was certain. I'd quit a long-time newspaper job, though I was well short of retirement age, and had two sons with college to finish up. I had a couple of things going for me, however. One was a supportive wife to hold everything together while I spent time in the field reporting for the book, which was about a major wildfire the previous year in Colorado, the South Canyon Fire, which took the lives of 14 firefighters on Storm King Mountain. Another was a family log cabin in western Montana, built long ago by my grandfather, where I could headquarter while doing the reporting job, which had many links to Montana. I also had a deep-seated desire to live off the land, to chop my own wood, carry my own water, and subsist in part on game I harvested myself. I was aiming high, but once in a while, you should push all the chips you have into the middle of the table. Thank you, Paul. And this was one of those times. Anyway, it worked out. And I went on to write five books about fatal wildland fires in which people were burned to death. And it's getting, sometimes, you know, you don't know how bad you feel until you start feeling good again. And I was feeling bad, and I didn't really know why or how bad. And I went fishing, just like Nick Adams in Big Joe Harden River. That's the way I kept myself fairly sane during this whole period. I would go fishing. And Storm King Mountain, the Colorado River, is right at the bottom of the mountain. And I go up and spend a day at the grave sites with the people who would come there, get their stories, hot, dry, and go down and fish. And my Labrador retriever, Robert, would go down and just plop in the water. So I was fishing in Montana, and I caught a great big rainbow trout. I've never seen a trout that big. Bull trout, yes, but not a rainbow that big, ever, in the Blackfoot. And I remember I sat on a log and I started to think. And I had a lot of long thoughts. And the friend I was with, who owns the ranch next to the hole where I was fishing, eventually asked me if I would write a story about that that fish for his newsletter, the Chicago Anglers Club newsletter. So I did. I wrote three or four paragraphs. And another friend read that and said, that's a really good Montana story. Why don't you write that for Big Sky Magazine? And they'll pay you. And they did. And that was it, I dropped it. 2 years later, an editor from New York, Peter Hubbard, bright young guy, was in Livingston on vacation, and he picked up an old ragged copy of Big Sky Magazine and read the story and called me up and said, would you like to do a book on this? And I said, no, I would not. He said, I've been through this with all the firebooks. He said, when I started out, there was a lot of noise about, you know, this is just him tagging on in slobber, he's not the writer, his father was, yucky, yucky, yuck. And I shut him up. It's taken me five books, but I have my own reputation. It's a very good one. People fear me, they respect me, they like me, some of them. I defend firefighters, and everybody knows it. So why should I take on a river run through it? Then I started thinking of the stories I would be able to tell. And one of the stories that I wanted to tell was the factual story of Paul McLean. Because you can start drawing some lines here between Nick Adams, John McLean, and Paul McLean. And I wanted to get that straightened out. So there were other stories that were nicer. Home Waters is a pretty nice book. The thing I decided at the beginning when I was writing, this ain't gonna be a Dear Daddy where you rake over your parents. If you cannot honor the people who gave new life, I don't wanna hear from you, basically. Go tell it to the minister, not to me. And there are books like that. Everything Daddy did dirty. Come on. Honor your parents. But I think I did that. And I began to feel better. And for the first time I realized that I wasn't feeling very good. I got a call from the community library of Ketchum, Idaho, asking me to come out via Zoom. It was during the pandemic. And give a talk about Home Waters. So I said, sure. And I realized that Big Two Hearted River is mentioned in Home Waters, and I should say something about Ernest Hemingway. So I went back and read the story, and I almost fell off my chair. It was so fresh. It was so beautiful. The rhythm of the words is so, he called it clumsy, and it's rough. It's what really happens, you know? People say, well, he learned everything he ever learned about writing at the Kansas City Star-Style. Nonsense. I was a newspaper man for 30 years. I know what newspaper writing is. This is not newspaper writing. This is literature. That is startling literature. So I got very excited about it. I went on in this way to my editor, Peter Hubbard, and he said, well, when was it published? I said, 1925. He said, oh, well, it's PD. Yeah, that's interesting. Have you ever noticed when somebody uses a piece of jargon and you have no idea what it means? If you just keep your big mouth shut for a couple of minutes, they'll come back to it and explain it to you. He said, well, yeah, let's see, 1925, 75 years before it becomes public domain. So PD, public domain. And so that means we can go ahead and pick it up and not worry about copyright. When we begin Home Waters, one of the things that I asked for was a set of wood engravings in the book. And I did it very consciously as an echo of A River Runs Through It. If you've seen the first edition of A River Runs Through It, the beautiful blue book, not invented, somebody knows their stuff. There are lovely wood engravings all through that. And a few years before all this happened, a guy called me up and he said, my name is Professor Hughes. I'm doing an essay on the illustrations in A River Runs Through It, all the editions. I'm having trouble at the University of Chicago. They won't help me. So I called the University of Chicago and I said, what we want to know is who did those illustrations. They said, oh, well, that was Robert Williams. He was the artistic director at the time. Fine. Can I talk to him? Well, he's in his 80s, but he's retired here in Hyde Park. So I called him, I said, Mr. Williams, and said, we've all had a question about the cover of the first edition of the Blue Book, because there's a big cliff and the river swirling around and forest, it's beautiful. Where is it? Because people have been up and down the Blackfoot River trying to find that, and it's not on the Blackfoot. And then they said, oh, it must be the Smith River. It's got to be Montana. And the inquiry kind of petered out. He said, well, it's none of those. It came from my imagination. So I thought, that's what I thought the book indicated. I said, oh, because I know that my father brought back images from Montana, photographs, drawings, and whatnot. And those were basically, the rest of the image of the stuff in the book is basically tracings of those. He said, absolutely not. So those are all original, scratchwork drawings that I did. So I put him in touch with Professor Hughes, who then wrote a long article that appeared in the Journal of the American Fly Fishing Museum and won an award as the best article of the year. Wonderful article. All the editions are in there, including all this stuff. So I told my editor, Peter Hubbard, said, let's do that as a conscious invitation. Take it on. You know, we know that there are going to be comparisons where the river runs through it. Let's meet it head on and make it like that. And he said, it's expensive, but I will go and talk to my business people about that. And HarperCollins, which is a major publisher, Worry and Mariner Classics, which is a division, said yes. So we started doing them. So one thing I want to do differently is I want these illustrations tied to the text. And I want to be able to comment on them. So they allowed me to do that. And we went around and around on some of these things, you know, four or five drafts to get them just right. And some of them was really fun. There's a whole long chapter on the Road to the Buffalo. And the illustration is two Native American women on horses with travelogue going down the Road to the Buffalo, which goes through the Blackfoot Valley and connects the Indians on the west side of the Continental Divide with the Buffalo Plains to the east. Ancient artery, like an interstate highway. And I looked at it and I said, there's something missing. And I called him and said, what's missing are two dogs. So the Indians always traveled with dogs. And you need something down in the bottom there. So they put them in there, and it works. And I thought, you know where that really came from? That came from Charlie Russell's When the Land Belonged to God. Yes, where you have the wolves. Yeah, and it's the same thing. It's exactly the same scene. And there are all these hits going on. Then I began to think more about Big Two Hearted River and how we really wanted to do this proud, but we had basically a short story. And this time on Big Two Hearted River, when we set out to do it, there wasn't any argument about wood engravings. Peter immediately got a very fine wood engraver, Chris Warbaum, to do the engravings. I mean, our problem, technically, was that Big Two Hearted River is a short story, and this is a book. So I would call Peter and I would say, this thing is getting long. I'm finding out all kinds of things. I traveled to Boston to the JFK Library, and Mr. Hemingway was a pack rat. I looked at all the drafts of Big Two Hearted River. They go back to 1923, the first three-page draft written in this almost florid scroll, very beautiful handwriting, very free. Is this?
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
He always wrote longhand. The only exception was conversation, was dialogue, because he said that came too fast to him, and he had to type it, you know. But otherwise, it was always a longhand.
Well, there is this longhand version in 1923, and then as the story gets longer, there is well-typed versions, I think, happening as Wolfer's wife was doing that. And then you get toward the end, where you're getting close to publication, and the whole thing is in longhand. And there's almost no correction in it. Very, very minor. I mean, the flow is just like this. Wonderful, wonderful experience. And as I was reading it, I got another shock. Reading the story after half a century, I was surprised to see how much of my book, Home Waters, runs parallel to it. The key anecdote in Home Waters involves a battle with the biggest rainbow trout I've ever seen in the Blackfoot River. In the Hemingway story, when Nick loses his big fish, he thinks, quote, by God, he was the biggest one I ever heard of. During the struggle with my big fish, my partner yelled at me as the book reports, it's like a salmon. When I read Nick's comment about his big fish, quote, he looked as broad as a salmon, I was shocked. It gave sleeping memory a jolt. Big Two Hearted River had stayed with me for over half a century as a smoldering ember that refused to die. By then, I'd realized, by writing about fatal wildland fires, what lingering embers can do. Fires in great literature have this in common, that they burn off in the lives of those they touch. So Big Two Hearted River is kind of the family story for me and for my father. We memorized quotes from it. We tossed them out on camping trips. And then I abandoned it to go into the newspaper business and didn't read it. I don't think my dad read it. He taught Hemingway. He taught The Old Man and the Sea. He taught some of the other short stories. I don't ever remember him teaching Big Two Hearted River. It would have been a real experience if he had, if he was full of self-realization at that time, of how much that story allowed him to do what he did. Because honestly, it's possible that none of the MacLean books, or Tennant, would ever have been written without Big Two Hearted River. It takes me about 5 years to do a book, and I don't have 5 years to do a book. I worked on the Yarnell Hill fire for 6 or 7 years and abandoned the project because I defend firefighters. And I found at the end of 6 or 7 years that the thoughts that I'd had about that particular fire and how 18 members plus one superintendent of the Yard, Brandon Mountain Hot Shots, had died in that fire. How that had happened. The thoughts that I had at the beginning were the thoughts that I had at the end, and they were not kind. It was a real screw up. Wrong time of day, wrong part of the country, wrong topography, wrong weather, wrong season, wrong everything. went ahead and did it anyway. So I wound up writing shorter things, and I'm happy with that. I have another foreword I'm working on. I have a speech to give next year. I must have a death wish, because the speech is on the 75th anniversary of the Van Gulch fire. So here we go again. You know, that's my dad's fire. I wouldn't have any trouble talking at the South Canyon fire, but here we are talking about Van Gulch again. And I look forward to it. I've written about Van Gulch, and I think I have something to say about it after 75 years. The 50th anniversary, the last survivor, Bob Scully, spoke. I was pretty good friends, or I was well acquainted with Bob. He and I kept appearing at the same places. I took him into the Gulch once and recorded all his thoughts. And we had a close relationship on Van Gulch until his death. Now, at the 50th anniversary, he told his story about what it was like to be in Van Gulch on August 5th, 1949, in Ceylon. And it, very matter of fact, very quiet, on the lawn of the Capitol in Helen. And I swear to you, you could have heard a dime drop on the grass. There just was absolute silence, rapt attention. But at the end of it, he said, you know, it's been 50 years. Maybe it's time to let this go. Well, here we are 75 years, so we haven't let it go. We're still hanging on. My job, next August 5th, if God gives me the time to be there, is to explain why we have been unable to let Van Gulch go. And I have some things to say about that. But in the meantime, I go fishing. I went fishing today on the Dalton. It was a beautiful day to be outdoors. Nice trico hatch, and the sun just killing the fishing, glinting all over the water. And I never saw one. Even a small riser. So I write shorter things. In the early fall, before the river clogs with fallen leaves, you can fish again in the afternoons, not wait for the cool of evening. October caddis pitter along the water's surface. Unless there's a big trout there to take them, they drop their eggs and almost miraculously regain the air. The world slows, but the trout unlimber after the sluggish summer months and gorge themselves before the snows fly. More than any river, lake, or stream, my father loved the Big Blackfoot River, most of all at dusk, when fish rise and old memories surface. From those and countless other times, he caught the unspoken words and rhythms of the river, and in time, and in his own words, he passed them on.
You've been listening to Valerie Hemingway and John McLean discuss Ernest Hemingway's book, A Big Two-Hearted River, recorded at the Bozeman Public Library on September 29th, 2023.